Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Michelle Luke. She's a conservation scientist and advocate with 15 years' experience in biodiversity conservation on public and private lands around the globe. Dr. Luke is the National Carnivore Conservation Manager for Project Coyote, whose mission is to promote compassionate conservation through science, advocacy, and education. So first off, thank you again for your work in the world, and thank you again for being on the program.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
So today I would like to talk about a horrible subject, which is wildlife killing contests. Can you say what they are, what's their history, and move us into what is their current status?
Sure. So wildlife killing contests are events where people compete for cash or prizes like guns by killing the most largest or even smallest animals. The species most often targeted in these contests are usually unregulated by the state wildlife agency. So that means coyotes are often a number one target of wildlife killing contests, but they can also include foxes, raccoons, skunks, even squirrels and rabbits, all kinds of animals where there are open seasons and no regulated take of the species. So folks go out often with semi-automatic weapons, with very high-tech gear for thermal imaging or night scopes, all kinds of fancy high-tech equipment so that they can kill the most animals as possible to win sometimes pretty large cash prizes, or as I mentioned, even more guns and equipment to go out and kill wildlife. So there's, various reasons why these folks say they should be allowed to conduct these contests. But really, science doesn't support any of their provided justifications. We really know that unregulated killing of particularly carnivores in this manner just does no good and might actually increase bad. So they say that they're trying to address conflict, but really this sort of chaos and this sort of killing across a landscape can really increase chaos and increase potential for conflict between carnivores that would normally have stable populations. But this killing disrupts all of that and might even increase conflict between humans, domestic animals, and carnivores. So you asked about the history of these killing contests. Based on my evidence and knowledge, they were not that popular, and they've increased in popularity in part because of the availability of this high-tech equipment. So back in the day, traditional hunting usually had a little bit more of a sportsman-like content to it, an ethic, I should say. And these contests are not sportsmanlike whatsoever. I mean, using this sort of gear, they often use calls that mimic either injured prey or even the calls of their own young to call in animals. So often these folks sit and wait. They call animals to them and they kill as many as possible. So nothing about this is sporting, especially when you look at the kind of high-tech equipment they use and the amount of money they spend on this equipment. So we're seeing potential increases in this kind of, I don't even want to call it hunting. They're not hunters. I have family and friends who are hunters who put food on their family's table from wild game meat. And these folks are not hunters. And the people I know would never want to be called hunters. These are killing machines for entertainment and for cash and prizes. So it's just really not in line with any sort of hunting ethic that we see in North America or elsewhere. So it's been increasing in a number of years because these competitions can bring in big money. They'll say they're trying to help a local farmer, but we know that if anything, they're just increasing conflict. They say they're fundraising, but obviously there are many other ways to raise money.
So I wanna learn more about the contests themselves in a moment, but there's something I want to mention, which is that I live in bear country, and there a couple years ago I saw that a mother bear with a cub, the cub disappeared, and I read up about this, and sometimes male bears will kill the babies in order to bring the mother into estrus. And that was seeming like a terrible, like a terrible waste of evolutionary energy. You know, if you're going to do that from an evolutionary perspective, why waste 6 months of the mother's life? Why not do it sooner somehow? You know, if you want to have your seed instead of somebody else's. So I looked more into it. And what I found was really interesting, which is that in many cases, this is going to have a point, don't worry. In many cases, the reason that another bear will kill the baby is because the social structure of the larger bear community has been disrupted by the killing of the, quote, alpha bear, end quote. That basically what this means is that there's an overarching male who will basically keep all the younger males in line. Mm-hmm. And when that male is killed, they've done studies on this in Finland, I believe. When that male is killed through hunting or through, there's a sort of vying for the throne sort of, I hate that hierarchical language, but the point is that the social structure is disrupted. And I thought of that because of what you were saying about this leading to more conflict. So before we get back into the nuts and bolts of a killing contest, can you talk a little bit more about how this might be true for other social structures as well, that disrupting the social structure, you've said several times, it makes problems worse. Mm-hmm. That's what made me say this whole long, boring story. So can you talk about, do you see what I'm getting at?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think it's boring. I think ecology and some of these surprises are endlessly fascinating. So I appreciate that, bringing that into bear ecology and life history. And I'll say we see similar social structures in lots of animals. African lions also will show infanticide patterns in the same way. Just another example. It happens in lots of places. But yeah, so to the social structure of, let's focus on coyotes, for instance. Coyotes are great at adapting and living near people, and they can withstand high levels of mortality. So in the case of unregulated killing of coyotes, they can respond by higher fecundity is the word that we would use as ecologists or wildlife biologists. But basically that means they increase their reproduction. Their fertility rates go up. They can enter sexual maturity at an earlier age and have larger litter pup sizes. Because there's potentially for a while, at least, less competition over food. So you wipe out a number of coyotes in a population. There's more food to go around. So you eat a ton of rodents and rabbits. There's less competition. And then you can feed a lot more young mouths. So then you get more pups. And so within 8 months of an unregulated killing event, you see the coyote population respond and perhaps even exceed its prior size. And so this sort of this is kind of the overall population instability that is created by this sort of anthropogenic mortality, this human caused mortality. But we also see family dynamics completely disrupted when you take out individuals that have been helping to feed young pups. Female coyotes will also, you know, just like wolves, often only the breeding pair, sometimes referred to as the alpha male and female, although that's sort of outdated terminology now. We really just say the breeding pair, which is mom and dad. The younger females, their fertility will be suppressed, so they don't also have pups in the same pack when they're hanging around with mom and dad and helping raise younger siblings. So that whole stable structure is, you know, totally disrupted when you take out one of the parents, one of the breeding pair, and you might have several females then able to have pups. So, you know, some people liken this situation to encouraging teenage pregnancy, basically, where you have young females having lots of pups and needing to feed all those pups and not necessarily being the older, experienced adults that know how to hunt native prey. And so that's when you start seeing carnivores switch from their native prey, to easier targets like domestic animals. That's part of why we say the potential for conflict can increase when we see this sort of unregulated killing.
And I'm thinking of one more story, and it's that I know that there were a bunch of, this is many years ago, a bunch of orphaned elephants in Africa were, it was a group of young males who were behaving atrociously, doing things like raping rhinos to death. Mm. And the elephant managers, and there's a problem with that phrase right there, the elephant managers didn't know what to do, because this was obviously a very bad thing happening. And eventually they got the idea to introduce some of the grandmother elephants back to this group. And basically it took like 6 months for the grandmothers to whip the young bulls back into shape. Mm-hmm. And I'm just saying that in terms of the importance for social creatures of these stable social dynamics of learning how to be a coyote, learning how to be a wolf, learning how to be an elephant, learning how to be anything.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, particularly for highly intelligent social creatures like elephants or coyotes or wolves, it's silly for us to think that they don't have culture and that they don't have cultural trauma when we're disrupting and basically wreaking havoc and creating a genocide for their populations. I mean, I talk about this a lot with the current situation in Wisconsin with wolves. They had a terrible hunt in February during wolves breeding season, and they're allowing the use of hounds to chase down wolves. These are indelible traumatic experiences that wolves are going to remember. If you were, I don't want to say lucky or fortunate enough, but I mean, if you're one of the wolves that survived this traumatic experience in February, you're not soon to forget what hounds did to your pack members, and you're going to learn. And so there's another instance of increasing the potential for conflict by using hounds and baiting and all these other egregious, archaic, cruel practices. We're expecting these animals that are intelligent to learn and to do what they can to survive. And that might mean fighting back against domestic dogs more than they would have before. So it's just these practices will come back to haunt us and, you know, future generations of wolves for a long time and coyotes.
So let's run through the mechanics of a hypothetical or real animal killing contest or wildlife killing contest. So like, how much does it usually cost to get in? How long does it last? Is it one day of slaughter, or is it a week, or is it, and how many people might participate, and so on?
Okay. Yeah. So there's a good amount of variability in these contests. They occur across the United States. We've worked to ban them with our coalition of over 50 national and local organizations. We've banned them in 8 states, most recently in Maryland, but they occur across the country. So there's some variability and there's some uncertainty in our knowledge, because as public scrutiny increases, contest organizers and participants increasingly go underground. So it's really hard to find some of this information. We try and track what's happening and where they occur, but most the advertisements for contests are privately shared in private social media groups, or are only posted locally in posters and flyers at the local bar that might be sponsoring the contest. So a lot of uncertainty in our knowledge base, because they're increasingly going underground, because they know folks don't approve of this because it flies in the face of all ethics and morals and even reason or science. So what I can tell you is that usually the fees are relatively nominal, and contests often will occur over the course of a weekend. Sometimes they can just be one day, but often they're over the course of a weekend. We're also seeing an increase in online sponsored events, which means somebody will post a video on a private hunting group and say, okay, you've got a week or 2 weeks, or maybe it's still just a weekend to kill as many coyotes as you can. And here are the rules. You've got to show that the body is still pliable so that it's not an old carcass. You've got to put a certain kind of wooden block in its mouth. You've got to say this secret word or this combination of numbers so that we know this occurred after I, you know, announced this new killing contest. So some of them happen locally, just sponsored by a local bar. Some of them happen online and could be including participants from across the country, including states that have banned them on their public and private lands, potentially. But people could be essentially working a loophole to still be killing coyotes in particular and other unregulated species. Because if you have a species that has no closed season, no bag limits, no regulations on take, you can be an online killing contest participant in, say, New Mexico, where it's banned. But, you know, it's hard to enforce that sort of thing if you're still just allowed to kill coyotes without any sort of limitations. So I don't know if I'm answering your question, but those are some of the details. And the cash and prizes can also vary. I believe some of the pots of money can be really big, such as Texas has a really big contest called the Big Bobcat Contest. And some of those cash prizes can be quite a bit of money.
You haven't mentioned prairie dogs. Don't they have them for prairie dogs too?
I believe so, yeah. And they have rattlesnake roundups as well. So those are two other species that are vilified for no good reason at all, no evidence to suggest that prairie dogs are breaking, you know, the legs of cows with their prairie dog holes or anything like that. But there's these myths and misunderstanding about these species that vilifies them.
So I've known about wildlife killing contests for a long time. So that, I mean, it's horrifying, but honestly, the thing you've said so far in this interview that has horrified me the most is the word increase. And is that true? Are they real? I mean, I would have thought that this was, you know, sort of relegated to the days of bear baiting and, you know, it's, this is something that happened a lot in the 19th century and has dropped off, but it's sounding to me like you're saying that's actually, did you use the word increase?
Yes. And I mean, that's based on anecdotal evidence. And, you know, as I said earlier, you know, our information is imperfect on these sort of things. But anecdotally, our understanding of how culture has shifted is that these things might have happened. You know, folks would get together to kill a bunch of coyotes one weekend for, you know, at the behest of a local rancher, thinking that might actually do some good when it doesn't. So those things might have happened to a certain extent, but to our knowledge, it looks like the organization for cash and prizes and the use of these high tech guns and equipment to do night hunting and that sort of thing may be increasing. But it also, I mean, it's again, it's anecdotal. Our knowledge of these things could also be increasing. And again, it's imperfect because as we start to increase awareness and build public awareness and daylight these bad deeds, these things go underground. So it's kind of hard to say with certainty whether or not they're changing, but they're definitely not going away anytime soon. And it's creating a schism in the hunting community because, as I mentioned before, there are ethical hunters. When we fight wildlife killing contests, we're not fighting all hunting. We get accused of that all the time. But ethical hunters who target a prey species like white-tailed deer that because we've killed their other predators might need more controlling. You know, most Americans are okay with that. They say, okay, you're putting food on the table. You have a certain connection to nature, whether or not I would walk through nature with a gun to take a deer, you know, might not be my pastime, but most people respect that might be a pastime for some folks. And that's decreasing. And at the same time, wildlife killing contests are gaining more popularity or entering the limelight more and giving a black eye to the responsible hunting community. And that's that's something that often isn't appreciated in all of this, that, you know, there are ethical hunters out there that want to put wild game meat on the table. And they are against wildlife killing contests just as much as we are. And they're some of our most highlighted voices and stakeholders in this issue, because they don't want to get a black eye. They don't want to be confused for these killing contest participants that post pictures on social media of a pile of dead coyotes with their kids standing on top of them, disrespecting the bodies, also holding guns, learning to treat nature in this way, which is not what we want future generations to see. And that's another important consideration, is that this is just, if this is what certain kids are being exposed to as a connection to nature, you know, we're headed in a very, very dark place.
Many years ago, I was talking with a friend of mine who was a hunter, and he said he was going to go hunting that weekend. And I said, well, I hope you have fun. And I got the dirtiest look and a lecture from him on, this is not fun, this is gathering food. Mm-hmm. He says, I'm not doing this for fun. I'm doing this so my family can eat all winter. So don't tell me. That was an important point in me understanding the attitude of at least some hunters.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think there's a scholar, Stephen Kellert, who did a lot of work to survey various different kinds of hunters. And he has different labels for them. One is the nature hunter, the individual who mostly goes out just to be out in the woods. And that's their connection to nature. And they might carry a gun. Maybe if the right opportunity struck, they would take advantage of it to procure some food. But often, you know, there's a contingent of hunters who go years without ever sighting in the scope. So, there's a variety of values and motivations and behaviors within, you know, any kind of stakeholder group, including hunters. And so there's a variety of motivations and ethics. But what we see with wildlife killing contest participants is a total lack of morality or value for wild nature. That's not what this is about. It's about killing for entertainment, which society by and large has said is wrong.
So I've debated whether to ask this question, because I'm really tired of, frankly, I've gotten really tired of lefties bashing everything right wing. And I say this as a longtime lefty, but nonetheless, I'm going to ask, are there geographical associations with the places where these are most popular? And I guess part of what I'm getting at is, I lived in Nevada for a couple years, and northeastern Nevada, and very rural. And it was honestly one of the most nature-hating places I've ever lived. Mm. And I'm not saying everybody there was nature hating. There were some people who weren't, but the people would just openly talk about, wow, if I ever see any endangered species, I'm going to do the three S's, shoot, shovel, and shut up. Mm-hmm. And so are there commonalities of the places where these are less popular and places where it's more popular, without explicitly demonizing, even though I just demonized northeastern Nevada?
Sure. Well, you know, in one sense, these contests are still occurring across the country. So it'd be hard pressed to say that there's any particular region in the U.S. where it's more popular than other places. I would say that, you know, I'm also tired of the age old rural urban divide. You know, that is still a thing. It happens and it's playing out. And that's a part of what's going on here. But I really think it's about identity groups and about, you know, the three S's of shoot, shovel, and shut up for endangered species. We see that happen across the country wherever, folks are worried about private property more than anything else. So, you know, those sort of controversies have occurred in Texas. They've occurred wherever wolves are. They've occurred, you know, over endangered butterflies in places. So it's not necessarily even regulated to a certain region or a certain species. It's really kind of about values and identities of the human groups that are concerned about certain rights over others. So I would say that's probably where the pattern that explains where these are popular more than other places. But again, we see them still across the country. In Nevada, it's particularly popular, mostly because many of the surrounding states, the neighboring states to Nevada, have banned these contests. So New Mexico, Colorado, Arizona, California have all banned wildlife killing contests to some degree. So that's pushing folks into Nevada because they can't participate in these contests in those other states. Is there a reason why Nevada is one of the last holdouts in the Southwest? Perhaps. I'm not really sure. It'd be speculation. Obviously, we expect places that are purple or lean blue, like California or Colorado, to be the first to ban these contests. It might fall along political divides as well a little bit. But, there are a lot of elements at play here. So it's hard to speculate too much.
So you've said that these that in many places coyotes and other creatures are, the killing is unregulated, which to my understanding means they can be killed with impunity. And so do these killing contests actually happen enough to be significant causes of mortality, or are they mainly flashpoints for just how much this culture doesn't like nature? Do you see what I'm getting at? Are there enough of these? I mean, if it doesn't take a killing contest for a rancher to shoot a coyote.
Correct.
And take this anywhere you want.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I'm tempted to say both. You know, it's a flashpoint. And it can have localized significant impacts on a population or an ecosystem. Again, because coyotes can respond with and compensate to this level of mortality. You know, the local saying is kill a coyote and two show up to her funeral. That bears out in the science and understanding of the life history of coyotes. So, overall, is the concern about population sizes and whether or not they're going to imperil a species like coyotes? No, that's less of the concern. And it really does come down to, is this how we want to interact with wild nature? Is this deemed moral and something that we should allow to continue, or do we want to regulate it and say this is immoral? But I would also argue that beyond just the ethics, there is an important impact to be creating chaos across the landscape like this. I mean, we don't have many carnivore populations to look at that are unexploited, that are not killed by humans at some level. And I would argue that the evidence is increasingly pointing to, increased conflict because of this level of mortality. So we don't even have a baseline. If we left coyotes alone, if we left wolves alone, we might expect conflict to go down really low. So I think those have important implications for whole ecosystems, because apex predators are so important to these ecosystems. And when you have a full stable ecosystem with the full complement of native species, including predators, you see higher increases in biodiversity. You see stabilized systems in a way that we just don't even know what that looks like, because we haven't been allowing that for hundreds of years. So I would say that it's potentially very impactful if we could take away unregulated killing of through killing contests and the other lethal control that we put on predators. But at the end of the day, it's less about the biology in the short term, and it's more about, is this a moral and good way to be in the world? And most folks would argue, no, this is killing for entertainment and cash prizes is not the way we want to go through the world.
Can you, for those who aren't aware, can you go through Like, for example, what happened when wolves came back to Yellowstone, just in terms of, or I have a friend who teaches at State University of New York, Binghamton, and there's a forest that was, what's the word when the college has has some land, anyway, there's like an endowment forest or whatever it's called. And the endowment forest, this friend of mine is, he loves amphibians and also ground dwelling birds. And they're getting hammered because there are so many deer in the forest. And so can you see where I'm going with that, right?
Yes.
And so can you talk a little bit about, you made the point, but can you talk explicitly about how predators like in Yellowstone or at this forest, if they were reintroduced in New York, how predators help everybody? And then I'm going to ask you, I'll ask you something else. Go ahead.
Okay. This is the story of trophic cascades. And the story was popularized by a video entitled How Wolves Change Rivers. And remind me to talk about a little bit of the blowback to that kind of overarching narrative. But first, I'll tell you about wolves in Yellowstone. So wolves were gone from Yellowstone for a long time, decades. And elk, you know, generations of elk learned to get really lazy and hang out at streamside riverbanks and over browse. And that changed the structure of the rivers, that reduced the vegetation along those rivers. And so instead of meandering, these rivers straightened because they could run faster. And there was more erosion because they didn't have vegetation holding up the stream sides. That also reduced habitat for songbirds that like to nest along those rivers. It changed the wetland systems that disadvantaged beavers. So there were all these cascading effects as we cleansed predators from the landscape. And then we have this wild place like Yellowstone where we can bring wolves back, and that changes the behavior of their prey. It doesn't necessarily change the number of elk on the ground, but it changes the way elk move. And this same story has played out in Wisconsin with a recent study showing that wolves save drivers. I forget what the amount of money is, but they save Wisconsin so much money because they change the way elk move, and that reduces deer vehicle collisions. They change how deer move in Wisconsin, and that changes deer vehicle collisions, I should say. So the same thing is happening in Yellowstone, where wolves change the behavior of their prey. This is sometimes referred to as a landscape of fear, where prey know that they can't just hang out at a riverside and browse as much as they want. They have to browse and move on to keep moving and avoid their predators. And so that has cascading impacts. The songbirds come back because the vegetation along the stream side comes back. Beavers come back because wolves will decrease the coyote population. Coyote prey then comes back to a certain extent. And so you see some of these, this is called mesopredator release, is when, you know, wolves go away and the smaller carnivores or mesopredators increase. And thereby putting down the prey species of that species. So, you know, it's a complex food web with all these different trophic levels. And the long and short of this kind of complex mechanism that works through the system is that when you have predators, things are, I hate to use the word balance, because that's also a mythology that nature is just, you know, we want to reach this steady state that's in balance. But overall, predators introduce a certain balance in the various populations that they impact, either directly or indirectly, if that makes sense. So it's a kind of balance overall, even though things do fluctuate and change based on, you know, other elements of change in ecology. So it's a complex system, but the long and short of it is that you reintroduce predators and you get increased biodiversity because you get the balances in the trophic system that evolved over millennia. And so restoring predators restores these systems and the ecosystem health and function of those systems.
You want me to remind you of blowback on that narrative?
Right. So this beautiful story of trophic cascades that we've seen play out in Yellowstone is sometimes harder to measure in other landscapes. And again, that's in part because of the complexity of these systems. When you introduce human change into working landscapes, sometimes you don't see the outsized impact of trophic cascades playing out when wolves or other apex predators are restored to other systems. Some of that might be, conflating variables. Some of that might be it needs to be measured on longer time frames. There's lots of questions. But this notion of trophic cascades got wildly popular as a way to talk about wolves. And some scientists said, maybe this is being overstated because trophic cascades might not happen in every system, and we should really be careful. So that's kind of getting into the weeds of debate among ecologists. But that just reflects that ecology is still a very young discipline. We have a lot to learn. But we do see in these wild landscapes huge, huge benefits of restoring carnivores. And we see these benefits at least in increased biodiversity and more stable systems wherever we restore native carnivores.
So the other thing I wanted you to really bring home is you've mentioned several times that killing coyotes or killing these killing contests often lead to sort of paradoxical results in terms of human or in terms of conflict, probably not so much human coyote conflict, but conflict with, I don't know, human lives or coyote livestock or coyote pets. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned about the wolves perhaps deciding they don't really like hounds, but and you've also said that they have more babies in response to it. But can you be really explicit? Well, it's back up because we haven't asked what are the stated reasons for these contests? Is it just, hey, come have fun? Or do they have a claim to virtue that, hey, come have fun, and you're going to, by the way, help all these ranchers around here because the coyotes are killing every single lamb or something? And what's the stated reason? And can you really bring home that it has a paradoxical effect of making the problem, the stated solution makes the stated problem worse? Because you've said it, but can you convince me?
Sure.
I think you see what I'm asking?
Yeah. So, there's a number of different motivations. One's to raise money, but obviously there are just other ways. People say that this is a sort of a community bonding where people come together to test their skills at calling in coyotes and then killing them. Some people will say it's a calling contest. That's what we're competing over. We just happen to, kill them all as they come in, which I think is just a distraction about what this really is, because they see that it's not defensible. But yes, some of them will claim that they're helping local ranchers by going in over a weekend and wiping out as many coyotes or foxes as they can find, or bobcats, when I haven't mentioned yet, I don't believe. That's not borne out by the evidence. So they say they'll go in and wipe out a bunch of coyotes. And again, our federal government does the same thing. They prophylactically kill coyotes during lambing and calving seasons. But as I stated, that only shifts a potential problem down the line at most a couple months because of the way coyotes respond to this level of mortality. So folks say they're trying to help a rancher while also having fun and community bonding and raising money for the local bar or charity that might get some part of the pot of money. But, there's just no evidence that they're doing any good. I feel like I'm just repeating myself, but it's really just, there's no evidence that this unregulated killing is going to help the rancher in the long run. What will help the rancher in the short and the long run is to invest in tools that prevent conflict before it ever happens. So you kill a coyote and you kill several coyotes and you have a pile of dead coyotes. That's all you get from a wildlife killing contest. And that's seen by some folks as progress. All of those coyotes might have attacked my sheep and now they're dead. But that misunderstands that there are still many more coyotes out there, and you've now created an unstable dynamic for younger coyotes to move in. And you might have killed a bunch of coyotes that weren't conflicting at all or ever looking twice at livestock. And you don't know that because you're just going into a place and you're wiping them all out. And so if you're not identifying a problem individual, you're not going to do any good. You're going to create a bigger problem because you're going to have more coyotes that need to feed more young mouths. And you've got unknown individuals coming in now that the territory is vacated by the coyotes that you killed. So it's not introducing more control into the system. It's introducing a lot less, and it's introducing chaos. So to prevent, if you really want to help the rancher, raise some money so that he can put up, better fencing or train some livestock guardian dogs. You know, invest in the things that science has said this will actually prevent conflict before it ever happens, and it allows livestock to be on the landscape with native carnivores.
So we've talked about what happens when wolves are present, and can you talk a little bit about the ecological role that coyotes might play in their larger natural communities? I have seen articles in mainstream newspapers about how it's a really good idea to wipe out mosquitoes. And this makes me want to scream, because mosquitoes are prey for so many creatures. I mean, if you get rid of mosquitoes, there go bats. There go a lot of dragonflies. They're great pollinators. It's extraordinary to me. So, what would happen, to the best of your understanding, if they succeeded against all odds at wiping out coyotes in a region?
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate the preamble to that question. You know, everybody has a role. Everybody has a niche in the environment that they've evolved in. And coyotes have a number of roles that they play. Sometimes they are the apex predator in places where we've wiped out wolves or don't have wolves. Sometimes they're just the largest carnivore in that system. And coyotes are very adaptable. So in some places, they are can take out some deer. But mostly everywhere that they exist, they're focused on lagomorphs, rabbits, and they're focused on rodents. So the ecosystem services that humans tend to think about, the most appreciated roles of coyotes, I think the thing that we would see more of if we didn't have coyotes is we'd lose all that free rodent control, all that free pest control, basically. And we'd see much higher rates of rodents and rabbits, who are another species really good at living near people. And so we have no idea how many, how much free pest control we get from coyotes living near us and eating the rodents that also like to live near us. So that, I think, would be one of the biggest things that we'd notice right away if we were able to wipe out coyotes, is that we'd be run amok potentially with rabbits and rodents in places. But as I mentioned, you know, the complex trophic cascades and the complex food web of an apex predator and their role, their top-down regulation role, coyotes bring those same benefits to ecosystems where they're the largest predator.
So we have about 5 minutes left. And can you start telling us? Well, you know, I've interviewed a whole bunch of people from Project Coyote, and I don't think I've asked actually what the organization is. So before we wind down, can you just give us a primer on the actual organization?
Sure. So as you mentioned in the beginning, our mission is to promote compassionate conservation and human-wildlife coexistence through science, advocacy, and education. So we're a national nonprofit organization that works across the U.S. To educate folks, not just on coyotes. You know, coyotes are our namesake because they're the most maligned species, arguably, anywhere. I think it's 500,000 coyotes are killed every year, which translates to one per minute. So something like 45 coyotes or more are probably killed during the course of, on average, during the course of this interview. So the most maligned species is the coyote. And so that's our namesake. But we work to promote coexistence with all kinds of carnivores, whether or not they are imperiled. So that includes grizzly bears, black bears, mountain lions, bobcats, gray wolves, you name it. Anybody who's potentially under threat of a lack of science to inform good policy that results in lethal control of predators is on our list to help protect. And so we do that through a network of ranchers, conservationists, scientists. Some of the world-renowned scientists, large carnivore scientists, are on our science advisory board, helping us use the science that they create, the best available science, to inform policy. So that's the kind of advocacy that we do. And then we also work to educate the public through our Coyote Friendly Communities program that does a lot of public outreach across the country, and through our youth education program called Keeping It Wild. So we really emphasize that tripartite, three-part triangle of science, advocacy, and education, because each one of those components is really important to doing evidence-based work to modernize wildlife management and move it to a more conservation than management paradigm.
So I have to admit that coyote songs are one of my favorite sounds in the world. Can you give a 2 minute? Can you give 2 minutes to helping people to fall in love with coyotes?
What a great question. I love the opportunity to. It might be hard in 2 minutes, but
you got more than two.
Sure. Well, you know, we've already talked about, kind of with our science hats on, the ecosystem services and the benefits to these systems. But I would also say that, you know, beyond their value to these systems, beyond that sort of kind of pragmatic view, they have a right to exist. They have intrinsic value. That means that they have a value to exist beyond their use to anybody else. So in a way, it doesn't even matter if we see these benefits or not. You know, they're a native carnivore to this continent. It's also often misunderstood. They're the truly most American canid. Gray wolves are found across the Northern Hemisphere. But coyotes, their range has expanded and contracted a number of times across North America. But if you're patriotic, you know, coyotes are truly American, more than just about any other species, really. So, you know, if that inspires you, I think that's great. And, you know, you mentioned their song, you know, they're musical, they're America's song dog also. So, you know, and they sing for lots of reasons, some of which aren't fully understood, but, you know, it's basically a family pastime. They're talking to each other. They're pulling in the group. They're bonding with those songs. Every time I hear them, there's a moment where I think, are there revelers in the forest? Is somebody partying? And then I realize it's coyotes. And it's just, you know, how do you describe that to somebody who hasn't heard it? It's just, to me, it puts a smile on my face. It's exciting. And it's, you know, I love to hear wolves as well, but their call is much more mournful. Coyotes are joyful in this way. And if you get the chance to watch a coyote playing, you know, the pups will play and that's great. But folks even report seeing adults playing. There's a famous, gosh, I wish I could remember the famous explorer who writes a great essay about watching a coyote play around with a stick. And that was an adult coyote, and it's this great story. I really should remember who writes it. But, you know, they're joyful, and they're up against so much. So I think there's a narrative in there to be inspired by anybody who feels threatened, who feels downtrodden, who feels like the world is against them, because that is coyote, you know, and they find a way to overcome. Despite the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, the poisons, the snares, the traps, the baiting, the helicopter gunning down. I mean, the ways that we kill and vilify coyotes is astronomical, and yet they survive and they adapt and they are not afraid to be near humans and still sing. I mean, the voice and the inspiration that that gives me, understanding what they're up against, and that, you know, they try to be cryptic and careful when they need to be, but that doesn't stop them from singing. I mean, how do you not feel inspired in your own life and the things that you have to overcome to still make your voice heard and send it out into the night sky? You know, that's the most joyful thing I can think of.
Well, that is a beautiful way to end. And thank you so much for your work in the world. And thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Michelle Lute. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.